we should get started. This is the third in the environmental set. The first night, we talked a little about the Mediterranean setting, but then at the end, used that as a way to suggest how people thought we in the U.S., a diplomat and others followed, said we better be careful to take care of our land so the same thing doesn't happen to us as has happened throughout the Mediterranean world. And then last night, we got into a decision-making model. I only want to make two follow-ups on that. I thought about this sketch, which actually was a, this is a 50-year-old sketch by a gentleman by the name of Walter Fiery, who did inform Gilbert White, whose model we used yesterday. And he said, imagine if you have to make a decision, each of these dots or lines in this whole box are the possibilities. And in a very short way, Walter Fiery said, well, first of all, you wanted to make sure that it's environmentally acceptable. That means it's going to have to be in this circle. All the rest of the dots are not good for the environment. But it has to be culturally adaptable. And I always use the example, it's an easy one. Somebody might say, well, to solve some of the food needs in different parts of the Middle East, Southwest Asia, North Africa, why don't we raise pigs? Okay, it would be not bad for the environment, but obviously you're not going to suggest raising pigs as a solution because it's not culturally acceptable. So, but the only ones that work for the culture are the ones that are in this circle. And then as a subset of culture, only certain things are economically feasible. And that's the point I tried yesterday. As much as we might like to be environmental purists on this, in the end, it has to be something the society can afford and culturally acceptable. So when you do all of that, Walter Fiery said, you really have only three choices left on the board. And that's a way of then thinking about environmental decision making. And certainly those of us who went on the hike today, and they mentioned, look, I mean, think how many, those of you who were here the other night, if you can think how you could use that decision making model, the perception on the outside, you got the Forest Service, you got the village, you got the EPA, and you've got the construction company, and you've got the company, mining company, and then they're trying to look at their range of choices, and you're hoping it will be acceptable for the environment, but do we have the technology to do it? Is economics available to make it work? What are the impacts upstream, downstream? One of the alternatives here would mean Narnia would have to close, so it's a spatial linkage that wasn't very favorable. And then what does the law allow? And then kind of what will society tolerate? And the last one would be, like he said, down at Chelan, Washington, where they're not sure how they're going to get a dock in there. And in order to get a dock in, they might have to call the area a Superfund site like this place is, and that way you qualify for something else. But the people in Chelan, the society norms and values down there, they don't want Chelan to be called a Superfund site. It won't exactly help the tourism business. So you see that what they actually lived out here is an example of what we did yesterday. And so just as that follow-up, one other follow-up, and that is if any of you who were there the other day were confused about the last point about the discount rate, here are a couple of simple charts. I didn't prepare handouts, but if anybody wants to have a look at the end of the hour to read quickly and see two examples about how a discount rate applies, that those two tables do an amazingly simple and good job of explaining a concept, tough concept in short terms. But what we're talking about tonight, then, is, okay, if we have to make choices, what does the law kind of allow, particularly in the United States, where we have private property rights, and yet you're trying to be conscious of the public good? And as you may know, not counting Alaska, but in the other, in the 48 contiguous states and Hawaii, added 73% of the land in the United States is in private ownership. And so if you and I, or those of us involved in a more professional way, trying to somehow manage the environment, how are you going to get the people who own 73% of the land privately, who think that they have the rights to decide what they can do with that property, how are you going to make sure that all 73% of these people of the country, of this land, is actually being managed according to natural processes? And you can't just say, well, everybody gets a choice. A lot of people don't know the right thing to do for the environment. So at what point can you step in and say, I know it's your private property, but we're going to tell you this is what you must do? And they say, I mean, you can't tell me to do that. It's my private property. Yes, we can, because the environment says we have to tell you to do that. oh my, here's where we then get the public good versus private rights. And for me, it's, I suppose, one of the topics that have been, I think, maybe the most interest, certainly one of a handful, for the last few decades. Once again, I'm going to give you some handouts, some right in the middle of this, and you're going to get involved in this pretty soon today with some choices on your own. But for me, a very good, fairly recent book dealing with this public rights, a public good, private rights issue is a book by Freyfogle, written in 2003, The Land We Share, Private Property and the Common Good. And I highly recommend that to any of you, obviously you're here tonight, and I hope some of you are here not just to fill the hour, but because you're genuinely interested in this. Freyfogle, it's on the back of one of the handouts. The Land We Share, Private Property and the Common Good, fits exactly into our theme for the evening. Just a few paragraphs from his introduction. Few ideas have bred more mischief in recent times for the beauty and health of landscapes and communities than the belief that privately owned land is first and foremost a market commodity that its owner can use in whatever way earns the most money. The appeal of this extravagant yet familiar idea is easy to perceive. What is harder to see, and what very much needs to be seen, is how costly, unfair, and disruptive the idea is, especially to people who care for their communities and natural surroundings and who yearn to live peaceably at home. Today's discussions have more to do with land use and conservation and with the rights and responsibilities that attach to the ownership of land, water, and other resources of nature. What rights should private owners enjoy, and what duties might society reasonably impose on them, given the problems of urban sprawl, decayed cities, and environmental decline? And so it gives a bunch of other paragraphs, but then says all of this together about how the rights of one owner can be the rights of one owner are restrained by the rights of neighbors. Private property, private rights, fit with pursuit of the public's well-being. How do they fit together? Private property is made possible by law, police, and courts. It is a social institution in which public and private are necessarily joined. Okay, just a few more in this. Far from arising from God or nature, private property was a creature of society, Franklin confidently asserted. As such, it was, quote, subject to the calls of that society whenever its necessities shall require it, even to its last farthing. All property was the product of public convention. And if part of the background, you read chapters of this, well, there hadn't been many other places in the world. You go back to Europe, and you had the feudal people on the land, and you had the monarchy on the land. So it's not like private property was really known few, if any, places in the world. And yet, in the American Constitution, the right was given of private property, and Freyfogle argues in the act of giving private property, that you and I as individuals, the right to own privately, we also, and since we had the right to give it to you, we also say we will give it to you on condition that you use it in ways which will benefit society at large. And that's what he says. With the, all property was the product of public convention, with the public holding full power to limit the quantity and uses of it. Franklin's point is more firmly stated, quote, property and law are born together and die together. Before laws were made, there was no property. Take away laws, and property ceases. Thomas Jefferson was among many who took a more intermediate view, mixing Locke's natural rights reasoning with Franklin's view of property as social convention. Jefferson spoke often of property as a vital individual right, even as he revised Locke's phrase, life, liberty, and property, to his now familiar life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The right of property for Jefferson chiefly had to do with a person's ability to acquire land for subsistence living at little or no cost. it was a right of opportunity, a right to gain land, not a right to hoard it or to resist public demands that owners act responsibly. And lastly, once the new nation began to function under the Constitution, private property was constrained less by moral concerns and natural rights reasoning than by legal powers held by the people collectively. Courts agreed that legislatures possessed broad powers to control how private land was used. We're going through all of this way because for the last 20 years, every time you went past a law that somehow will deal with the environment, there are people who step forward and say, I'm going to take it to court. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. I bought this property. I have the deed. And so then people are saying, well, wait a minute. How can we respond to that challenge? And so even then is this point, Freyfogle concludes this section, even for Chief Justice Roger Taney, a Southern conservative and author of the pro-slavery Dred Scott decision, to him, private desires were properly subordinated to public need, quoting from Taney, while the rights of private property are sacredly guarded, we must not forget that the community also have rights and that the happiness and well-being of every citizen depends on their faithful preservation. So there's some good stuff to think about here. And there's another book that I've read, The Constitutional Basis of Land Use Law. And we've got an attorney, a lawyer here, so it'll be interesting as the evening goes on and his response. But it goes back to suggest very, very early in our history. And I know even at the Plymouth Colony, where they drew up the documents and how to run that place, it still specified very precisely what people could grow and what animals they could keep in town and those that had to go out on the common, on the edge. So there it is, 1620 communities were saying, this is what you can do and this is what you can't do for the good of the community. And so it's a wonderful book, The Constitutional Basis of Land Use Law. Well, what can we then say? And this is a hand that I'm not giving you. We use it regularly in class, but anytime you get land use lawyers and people in the community talking about land, or any of you who buy the land, sometimes they say you and I, we own our house property, but each of us, when we have that property, we have green sticks, which are the opportunities that we have to use that land, as they say. In this case, green sticks. Person enjoys making it profitable or pleasurable use of the land. Green sticks include the right to build on or above the land, the right to till the soil and reap the benefits of its fertility, to cut its timber, to exploit its subsurface minerals, sometimes to use its water resources. All of this stuff then we know as fee simple absolute. You own the whole bundle of rights. This is the green stick. You own the land. These are your opportunities. But then they talk also, each of us have red sticks that go with that. Red sticks represent now the duties of real property owners. And these include the duty to pay property taxes, to refrain from creating a nuisance, such as a harmful externality to the neighbor next door, and to conform to applicable public laws such as zoning, building codes, subdivision laws, sanitary codes, stormwater fees, like we talked about that. That's the red stick. You own the property, you got a lot of things you can do, but you also have to do some other things out of the red stick's responsibility. So most discussions will get into that. Well, what does the Constitution say about it? And there are three key amendments that you may know on this. Certainly the Fifth Amendment. No person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Sometimes people forget the last three words. And it doesn't say that, some people say, look at the Constitution, says nobody can take the property. And in a minute we're going to talk about eminent domain. The government can take the property as long as they pay you for it. And they'll take you to courts and, you know, they have to pay a market value, and we'll talk about that. And there was a big case recently that we'll get to. So that one, nobody can take, and that's the one that's most often comes up in the law. And just to alert you what comes ahead, where it says, nor shall private property be taken. There's the literal taking of the land, but will be the case when you look at some of these case studies. what happens if you bought some lakefront property, which will be one of the scenarios. You haven't put a house up yet, but you clearly bought this lake property so you could look at the water, and then a state passes an ordinance that you can't cut any trees within 75 feet of the shore. Now, you say, wait a minute, all right, some may like to have a woodsy house, but you probably bought that lakeside property hoping to put up so you'd have a nice porch looking out on the lake. Now, you can't do that. Now, they haven't taken the property, but in fact, they have taken away the very reason you bought the property. And so in our course and places and books on this, it usually is put in quotes, the taking issue, where there is the official taking without quotes. We're going to take your land in order to put a highway through. But then there's the taking, and that's usually the one that comes up with environmental regulations. You can't do this, you're going to have to do that, you're going to have to do that all for the sake of the watershed or for the sake of the air quality or something else. And if you put so many of those things down, people say, well, you could just as well have taken the property. You won't let me use this. But then they say, because it says it's taken, therefore you ought to pay me. And you say, wait, no, we haven't taken the land. And they say, yeah, for all practical purposes you have. And now you get the court cases. How far can you go with a regulation before someone can claim, in effect, your rights as an owner have been taken away? So that's the Fifth Amendment. The 14th Amendment comes up, and that's a long amendment. In some parts that was 1868. No state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. So that means if you pass an ordinance for preserving wetlands in this part of the state, it really has to pertain to the whole thing. Or even at the college, the city of Rock Island passed an ordinance in which they wanted the city of Rock Island had too many noisy college students around. You know, you get 6-7 people living in a house and you can get some great parties, but it may not be very pleasant to the neighbors. So they wanted to pass an ordinance, no more than 3 people, unrelated people living in a house. All right, they passed that, and then that suddenly raised, what does that say to the Catholic Services kids' home in the neighborhood, which has more than 3 unrelated? They had to work that through and develop different laws, and so otherwise it sounds like you're discriminating against just the college students, and yet it's okay for 3 people living down here because they simply happen to be needy kids, need of home, need of service. But you're saying you can't do it for college kids, but you can if you're other. Oh, now you get equal protection. So there's all kinds of stuff on that. So the 14th Amendment then often comes up in land use cases, equal protection and due process. This drives land use planners nuts because due process is if somehow you said this, and again in our case, every place, you have to send out notices to let people know when there's going to be a hearing. Well, what happens if they're on vacation? And instead of arriving 2 weeks before or 3 weeks before the hearing, they're on vacation, they get home, they open the mail, gee, it's only 10 days to the hearing. So they can say, this is not fair. And they'll take it to the court and say, you didn't take adequate precautions to make sure that we didn't get that. And so one way you beat that is in Rock Island, we send everything by certified mail to anybody who's going to be near a land use decision. And some of you and I, and me too, sometimes you say, oh, this is a stupid thing. It was a good law, but it was nitpicked by the law. Well, there are reasons why due process. So, okay, land use, when I've gone to some of these workshops, I say, all right, everybody knows about the taking issue. But they tell our students and others, be careful about every little detail in that ordinance. You do it exactly right. Otherwise, the most noble idea can get tripped up because due process wasn't followed. So planners out there, they're usually very attentive to that. And the last of the constitutional ones, and that is the Fourth Amendment, which is reasonableness. If a law is passed, in land use work, you have to be able to prove that it's a reasonable law, that what it's at stake. And here again is what comes from a book by a lawyer, a friend of mine who's got a PhD in geography and then got a degree in law school. Reasonableness is thus often used as a surrogate for constitutionality. Here's the key question. Is the ordinance, or land use management rule, whatever we're talking about, related to a valid purpose of the police power, the right of the state to make a decision? And does it reserve for the owner some reasonable way to use the property, although not necessarily the most profitable one? That again alerts you to something that will come up as we near the end of the time today. The courts consistently have decided that they owe an owner the right to use the property in some way. They do not have any obligation to make sure you can use the land in the most economical way. And we'll look at some slides of a case study that is sort of his landmark in setting that aside. So we've got constitutional points, and one other one that wasn't an amendment, constitutional background. Courts seldom invalidate police power or public regulations under due process unless fundamental constitutional rights such as racial discrimination are involved. It is normally presumed by courts that the action of a state or a local legislative body is valid. For me in the planning world and teaching about that, I'm grateful for that. This is called the presumption of validity. So if your city passes an ordinance, or the state of Washington or state of Illinois passes an ordinance, it's presumed to be valid. You can't do this because it will harm the wetlands. Once that's passed, you have to prove that that was invalid. And think of those people in the environmental work if you had to do it the other way. You can't pass that until you prove that doing this actually will improve the wetlands. So there is this concept of presumption, of a zoning ordinance, a state requirement on land use management, a state requirement on water. It's presumed to be valid unless somebody, the opponent then, has to prove that it's invalid. And the last point that comes out of this that you want to watch out for, and this will set up some of our case studies, if anybody can prove that your the state legislature or your city council or county board makes decisions that are not consistent, they can take you to court and almost always win under the phrase that your decision-making is arbitrary and capricious. Last year you decided this for homeowner A, homeowner B brings almost a similar situation this year and you accepted it. That's inconsistent. Or if you don't give good reasons, why are you turning down this request by somebody to use the land in this way? And if you don't articulate, let's say they're just making a capricious decision. And so that's why for all of us, I'm not a planner, but I teach this stuff, serve on a commission. One of the things they always say, we've got to be careful that we are consistent. Because if somebody can find that you do one thing one month and then something else the next month, do this for this cluster of homeowners and not for these, you're going to lose. Somebody, a good lawyer, will be able to take you to court and that'll prove this, that this, the legislative body is acting very inconsistent. So I mean, think of those, keep those phrases in mind. Presumption of validity, which I think actually helps land use planners if they do their homework, but then be careful, or if any of you serve on a commission, for not being vulnerable to an arbitrary and capricious charge. So those are the points of background. Let's turn first to eminent domain then. What are the kinds of things where we really get into the public-private kind of issue? And eminent domain, as many of you know, it is within the power of, and it's been around for a long time, within the power of the government to condemn someone's property in order to accomplish a public good. There are several where you may know, an easy one to illustrate it, and I'm not going to spend much time on it, I'm in the domain. There are sometimes you have a road going through, a new road's going to go in, and everything is fine here except homeowner A absolutely loves the farm, loves the area, loves the woods, and just refuses to sell. And the state can put up as much money as they want in order to complete that expressway, and homeowner A says, I'm not going to sell. This forest has been family forever, I'm not going to sell it. But that's the only way that that expressway can go through. So then the government sues. They use the power of eminent domain to insist then that this be up. Then it goes to the courts, and of course you have to prove the legitimate public purpose for this, and it could be a hospital, could be for schools, could be for roads, anything that's genuinely for a public purpose. And then they'll have to agree on a price. And so you get the homeowners there and the state is there. First, you got to convince the judge that this is a legitimate use of eminent domain. And if it is, okay, then you have to find out, and eventually the homeowner gets a fair market price for that. And the judge decides, and they can appeal that, but it usually holds up. So that's eminent domain. It's been around for a long time, and many of you could probably bring cases about that. Then along comes a case, and I want to show you a few slides on that one, just a few. A place in New London, Connecticut. This was 5 years ago. It's the Kalo versus New London. And maybe if we could just turn out at least a little bit of the light. For just there are only about 10 slides to get back on. Yeah, this is fine. New London, an old town, depressed economy. But they came up with an idea for a wonderful development. Down, they have some wonderful old buildings that are there. And this is some of the shoreline, but behind this were places where there were abandoned warehouses, rundown properties, and so on. Not that rundown, but not real good. Well, the city proposed a very large-scale mixed-use development, which was going to have some homes for upscale housing, and it was going to have a place for some of the property was going to be for business, which would have generated jobs. And this is just the scenes of New London, Connecticut. Here's a view. This is a state facility that we see over here, a state park. This is, right to our right is the neighborhood that we're talking about. So this is the kind of shoreline scenery that would have had an old, old neighborhood off to our right. This is the view right across the street from the person who took this case, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and you'll see in a minute. What they proposed in this case, because it wasn't a public school or a hospital, to put, they were going to convert this into this mixed-use development. And they say, well, how could this be a public good? Because this would generate a lot of good high-income tax revenue now. Property, instead of having bladed or low-income properties, this would now be upscale housing. And so that would bring in a lot of tax revenue, which would then allow New London to do a lot of good things for the public, such as building more schools, building more roads, everything else that normally would have been perfectly okay. If they were going to put a hospital in this place, a public school, the neighbors wouldn't have had any choice. But in this case, what ticked these people off was that part of that property was going to go for private use. It was taking from this cluster of homeowners. There were 115 homeowners. 100 of them were willing to sell. But there were 15 of you who weren't willing to sell because you grew up in this neighborhood, this is your place, and they were ticked off that we were going to take your condemn your property so that we then could give it to the board of this corporation, another private one. And even though you argue, yeah, but that corporation is going to bring in a lot of taxes, and there are going to be a lot of other people going to be able to build these homes, and all of the rest of that, they said, still, we grew up here. I don't care. That company doesn't need to be here. And these are the people then who filed the protest. That was the property. You can see, look at jobs. 100 people were going to go ahead. This was already in. All of this was going to be the development. The water is off on the right. This is the woman who brought the charge, Kalo, and her little pink house, as one of the articles talks about it. That's one who had been there. She was one of the 15 owners. So I looked at this neighborhood. There's the woman. Right behind me, about a block away, unobstructed view to the Thames River, and they do call it the Thames River, looking out on this. And that's the view she'd looked at. This is a terrible slide. And it got walked right into the sun, but this is the woman's house, and so I still leave it in my collection because you can see what the water is like over there, how close she was. These are some of the homes that were there of the people who didn't like it. But by the time I saw this, they already had lost. This went to the Supreme Court, and by a 5-4 decision by the Supreme Court, they ruled that New London's use of eminent domain here, these people were paid, was a legitimate use because to put in this development, which would raise the tax revenue, was just as much of a public good as if a public school was going in. And it set off a firestorm around the country for that.
Yes? Did Chief Justice Roberts, was he the one who was the one who pushed this in front of the Supreme Court, that argued this in front of the Supreme Court?
I don't know the details. detailed the judge that, hey, I know that I followed the final decision. I didn't pay attention to who was doing what. This was solved in 2005, and so it could be that he was the one. I'm sorry, I don't know that. Maybe you know. I don't know.
You got questioned on something like business hearings.
Yeah, it very well could be. These are then the homeowners. You see, this already had been changed, but these are the homeowners who didn't want to get kicked out. Even on the fire hydrants. Eminent domain, not real popular in that town. Hands off my house. All right. So what happened in that case is, let's see, I'll turn the lights on again. That set off a storm around the country. And what happened, and this is a very recent report in April of this year, in one of the magazines, they showed what happened. And this map may be hard for you to see, but in the bold, dark blue, and I didn't have time to put this on a PowerPoint, I'm sorry, but the blue here, 21 states subsequently have passed laws, as they say here, for substantive reform of eminent domain, making it tougher. Because the Supreme Court decision, while they allowed this, they did say further that it would be up to the states. The states would still have the option of passing more restrictive regulations on when and when eminent domain could or could not be used. And so this was a case maybe where they won the battle but lost the war, the people who would vote for this. So across the country, 21 states have passed substantive change. Another 21, including Washington and Illinois, where I'm from, of course, Montana, Idaho, some around here, have passed increased eminent domain protections, 21 more, and still another 3 where the state needs to eminent domain reform. It's still in session. So if you put all of those together, you get very quickly, that's 45 states which were so offended by this, because citizens said, wait a minute, any time, if you allow that to stand in the states, almost any time that you would get people with a lot of money coming in, oh, let's turn this from a poor neighborhood into an upscale neighborhood, that's going to be a lot of revenue. And if that routinely could be used, they said, whose property will be safe? Follow that story. That's all I really want to spend on that one, and it's a big issue that's coming out. Now, I want to get you involved in this and have you make some choices on the taking issue. I want you to look at these cases. When you get this sheet here, we'll send some on that side. This is the one I use in class where we're not going to be able to go through all of these, and pass these around. I'd like you to look, and I'm going to go through some of these pretty, so you're going to have to, these are all complicated, so some of you will say, yeah, but what if and what not? But I'm going to try and set this up. Most of these won't be a sketch. I'm going to ask you to vote, yes or no. So you're going to, then we'll see, have a question for you as we move forward on this. And that is, the first one, you got a landfill site. And so imagine a road like this. Over here, this is, let's again, homeowner A. This is already past the geologist acceptability. This would be geologically, environmentally accepted place for a landfill. But you've got a bunch of homeowners here who are living right across this country road. They were used to owner A having a farm on that side. A suitable site's been identified. Local adjacent landowners don't want to see the site placed in the neighborhood because it'll lower their property values. Yet the owner of the land is willing to sell, claiming that it's her right to do it the property as she pleases. Should the public board approve the site? You're on the commission. They want this to be approved as the site for the landfill. Put in your cash, you don't have to hand this in, but put in the margin, is this going to be a yes or a no vote for you? A yes vote means you're saying yes, it could go to a landfill. A no vote means you're siding with the people on the other side of the street who don't want to look out on a landfill now.
What about maybe?
Pardon?
What about maybe?
No maybes allowed. No maybes allowed.
You got to be more generous than that.
No, we can't.
But other options have to be taken into consideration.
Well, that's yeah, all right. See, this is it. There are all kinds of, but this is the broad question. You could say, for, I'll say generally, the landfill sites are very hard to find in counties. So the fact that this one has been approved, probably the county might be pretty happy to get this because there aren't going to be too many other places. But I'm not saying it's the only one. In this case, it's more a principle. You want that kind of massive change across the street. That's the issue in question.
Are they going to be compensated?
Or they would have, well, undertaking, no, because this is they haven't done anything there. The person's just, well, these homeowners, do they have a right?
They lost property value.
You got to get a look at this one first. I see this, I was thinking we might here, pass this one around. Let's do this easy one first. Pass this one back. This is a fun one. Here, do this one first, folks. Now we'll talk this one out loud. This is a hypothetical scenario. And you've got the sketches in the right-hand side. Okay, we'll just read through it. You can go right down to the numbers. Homeowner B, so look at the sketches and read through. Number one, homeowner B enjoys the proximity of A's woods next door. They can look out their window and see a nice place. B benefits from the shade, the privacy, the bird life, and the opportunity for his children and pets to cavort in A's woods and to gather firewood there. A, for situation two, A, after discovering B's unauthorized use of the property, builds a fence that deprives B's family of the access to the woods. B is thus harmed, but can that person complain legally of being denied the right to trespass? What do you think?
No.
Is it okay for A to put up a fence?
Yeah. Yes.
Anybody object to that?
Who's paying for A to put up the fence?
Yeah, A doesn't want people going into the woods.
But he put up the fence and he paid for it.
So A wants, he's going to put the fence up, okay. And B's ticked off now. Our kids used to go across. Now you put this impenetrable fence there. Is it okay for A to put up a fence?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
But if you've had that right to pass there all those years, you'd assume that...
You just got by with it. You didn't have the right.
You were getting the argument generally in that case to dispose of it quickly would be if you got a nice house and you're looking out on somebody else's woods, you've been lucky for all those years that you had woods there and they didn't put anything up. But because they didn't do that all these years, you suddenly can't say, hey, you know, I've loved your woods for 20 years. I'm not going to let you do anything anymore. But that generally won't carry much weight. So I'll short-circuit that argument. Maybe it comes up here. Let's try number three, the next one. All right, how about number three? A cuts down the woods, thus additionally depriving B of the external benefits of shade and natural surroundings. Should the law prevent that externality? Does B have a right here to complain that B's cutting down trees?
Not legally.
No, that's what I'm saying here. This is legally.
No.
All right, most people won't object to that. Let's move on. This is a hypothetical.
Is there zoning or another consideration that requires something else? Because communities may have that.
Pardon?
Communities may have something that would restrict A's ability to do that.
This presumes it's not there. Otherwise, the person wouldn't have even brought it up.
Yeah.
This is just a homeowner. It's my property.
Yeah.
All right, number four. Now A decides to construct a house. It's the same style of B, so it's not really an intrusion. B, all the more now, loses privacy, and whose property declines in value, because now instead of looking out in woods, now it's looking out somebody who actually had the gall to build a house on her property. So should A be prevented from building a house?
No.
Okay, good. Now instead of a house, A decides to build an animal hospital. It will involve 24-hour floodlighting, incessant parking, vehicular traffic, and the stench of the furnace in which deceased pets are cremated. Does this comprise an unreasonable externality that a court might find to be an actionable nuisance?
Yes.
Now, all right, it happens in every case. You got the idea now. All right, now let's get to the more tough situations. So back to our situation here with the landfills. Yes or no? We got to go through this. Then we're going to take a total vote. Number two, everybody knows floodplains. The county proposes a floodplain ordinance to prevent additional encroachment into a potential hazardous area. Some of the landowners along the floodplain protest, claiming it would take away their right to sell their own land for development or to build a house on their land, which was their original intention. So should the new ordinance be approved? A yes vote means you're siding with the county or the city to prevent any additional development in a floodplain. And they would argue all the reasons why you'd want to build there, because there's a 1%, 5%, or 15% chance of flooding. And then the city has to pick up response. Therefore, we're not going to allow any more development. So should the ordinance be approved? A yes vote means you're supporting the city. A no vote means you're supporting the homeowners who don't want to have that. All clear on that vote?
Yep.
All right, the next one. We're going to skip the next two, number three and number four, though we're going to use it. We're going to skip number three, do number four. This is a legitimate issue in Wisconsin. Some citizens complain that too much of the shoreline on some Wisconsin lakes, on which have lived for several years, is being changed from woodland to more houses. Sketch will help. Here's our lake. All right, all of these people have lived here for a long time. They love their lakes. And this is all woods. And now it's catching on, people wanting to buy more lake properties. And so people have bought some of these properties. This is not in state ownership. These are all developed over here. These were under, they bought these properties. And now the state legislature says, you know, we're getting too much runoff from some of these residential properties into the lakes. The people are already there. They love the woods. They see the eagles and the birds on the trees on the opposite side. And so some citizens complain that too much has happened. And so therefore they've introduced an ordinance to require minimum setbacks with no alteration of the lakefront. 50 feet in some places, 75 feet back. You got to allow this natural shoreline. Then you can put your houses, whatever you want, back behind that. Well, obviously other citizens, particularly those who are planning to build, argue that they bought the property with the intention of getting a good lake view once they built their houses, and thus they oppose any such ordinance. Should the board approve the ordinance? A yes vote, meaning you're siding with all of these people, they should have a right to put their house up there. A no vote means you're siding with these owners, who say that'll change the whole character of Pine Lake.
The ordinance would approve the ordinance,
which would allow them to go there. I'm sorry if I missed it again. A no vote means you're siding with these people. It means you don't want that ordinance approved. You don't want, the other way around. Should the board approves the ordinance, it means these people have to house back. Thank you, I'm sorry. They have to have their houses back. A yes vote means they have to build their houses back. A no vote means no, they should have that right. Thank you for clarifying that. Yeah, sorry, I got careless. Okay, so that's that vote. The next, we're gonna skip five, six, and seven. Let's go to eight on the back side. Farmland conversion. It's an issue in the states, and we're going to talk more about some of this stuff tomorrow. Farmland is being converted at a rapid rate. To stem this tide, some counties propose ordinances which would restrict the conversion of prime ag land. And there are some states that do that, just like you have zoning in cities. There are some counties where if this is zoned for agriculture, you can't change it from that unless something else happens. To stem that tide, some propose this ordinance. Owners of this land argue this would take away their sales option, which would prevent them from making the same money from selling land for urban development like previous farms have done. Should the county board adopt a farmland preservation ordinance? A yes vote here would mean you are siding with the city or county, which is saying that land, once zoned agricultural, it has to stay that way. A no vote would mean you object to that because you own the farmland. You should be able to sell it off to the sprawling new developments as you wish. Cast your vote. Colorado condos. Condominium development is creeping up the slopes of the Colorado Front Range west of Denver and Boulder. The state proposes to limit further conversion of woodland for such uses. That is, you can't go up any further. That's too valuable part of the Front Range. It's okay down here, but once we get here, no, we're going to lose the whole view. We could have some environmental problems. The landowners, though, as expected, object, as do the real estate developers, since it would take away their sales options and accordingly limit the total growth potential of the area. My nephew worked in one of these counties where this was an issue. Should the state adopt this state proposal? If you say yes, it means that you are basically drawing a line. Some of you are from Portland, you know about urban growth boundaries, where you draw a line and nothing would be allowed above that, even though the homeowners say we should. the state would say you can't do that. In this case, then, a yes vote would mean that you will be keeping development below that point. A no vote would mean you're siding with the landowners or the real estate developers. The Connecticut shoreline. In Connecticut, an overwhelming portion of the ocean shoreline is occupied by private residences, which mean that most of the state's population must use relatively small public beach areas. A proposal, what this one, I tell you, it was defeated, but it was introduced, to require that a minimum strip of beach land, such as is already the case with tidal lands, if you don't know the coast, the property, if it's high tide, private property begins. When the tide recedes, this is tidal land, you and I can go walk right in front of the most fancy mansion around. You and I, as citizens of the United States, have rights to be able to walk in tidal lands. Connecticut said, well, if that's the case, why don't we then add any number of feet of beachfront? We got a lot of people in Connecticut, and we only have a few public beaches, and all the rest is controlled by the private people. So this was the ordinance. The owners, of course, of the private frontages, they strongly disagree, claiming it would take away the very site values they paid for when they moved there to have their oceanfront property. Should the state pass the Public Frontage Act? Cast your vote, yes or no. A yes vote means that would open that up to the public. A no vote means it wouldn't.
Would it take land beyond the tidal zone? Or
it would go up on the beachfront. It's already available, as we know, on the tidal lands. So if this is the case right now, here's our shoreline. All right, so that's not good. You got the shoreline during high tide. And then here's where the water would be to low tide. You and I already have access to that. And then the homes are sitting up here. And the proposal was, why don't we take this much of the beach and suddenly let that become the same way as tidal lands? They still own it, but we have the right to go and walk there, those of us who don't own the property. And that's what you're voting.
You presently have the right to walk the beach.
No, you don't.
No,
this is private property. Right now, this comes all the way down to here. So you and I can't go there. Those people think they've got a house on the ocean. They know they got the tidal property, but they think the beach is theirs. And this act, if it would have been passed, would have opened up the 10, 15, 20 feet. So inner city people from New Haven or people like my wife who didn't live on Long Island Sound, they still would have had access to go down and take advantage of the free Long Island Sound if this would have passed. Yeah, everybody, so see what your votes would have been. Interestingly, here I'll interrupt and just give you the quick legal case, which the Supreme Court just decided. Let's assume that this sand had washed away. Let's assume this had washed away. And now public funds are used to restore the beaches. So let's call this restored sand. And the Supreme Court 3 or 4 weeks ago decided 5-4, yes. So in a beach that has been restored with public funds, Corps of Engineers and the other, you and I can go and walk in front. It doesn't make any difference. Right in front of the people's property. Oh, because, geez, now this has people all ticked off. But this is another one of these Supreme Court 5-4 decisions. And the argument there is, look, they didn't have any beach left. The only reason they have a beach left is the tax dollars from the federal government was used to put that back in. And if that's your and my sand, by golly, you and I should be able to go and walk on that. Okay, these people weren't used to having our crowd in front of them on their private property. Grand Central. Grand Central has been designated a historic landmark. At the same time, it's a low-profile building. Here, again, I won't, this one would show the slide. You don't have to turn the lights down. I think you'll be able to see this. You know what downtown New York is like. This is a landmark case. So here we have it. Manhattan views, you know, you got skylines like this. And here sits Grand Central Station. Well, the commission, the Historic Preservation Commission, said they couldn't tear down the building. Almost 2 million people a day go through the station. So Penn Central decided, what happens if we build air rights? Have a nice support beam so none of this architectural detail would be compromised. But right above this statue, a little bit, you would start to have a building built on air rights. All right? And this would have been like an 80-story skyscraper. Well, the New York Landmarks Commission said no, because that too would change the character of the place, of central Manhattan. And they say, well, wait a minute, you still have the station that's here. And think of the economic value depriving of 80 stories of central Manhattan office space. So that if they are going to do that, that would be a taking, in quotes, and therefore they should get compensation. Well, in Penn Central versus New York, the Supreme Court decided, no, they do not have to be allowed to do that, and they don't deserve a penny of compensation. Why? Because Penn Central is a train station, and they will continue to be able to be a train station. Nobody took that right away. The Constitution says nothing about guaranteeing a private owner the right to maximum profit. This is 1978, and so it's become a landmark case. Any place where you live, if anybody argues, you can't do that, you're going to be taking away the economic value. They can just say, look, that probably doesn't have as much economic value as Penn Central for all these stories above it. So in the case here, I ask you what your decision would have been in a hypothetical way. What would you have decided? Would you, so a number 11, what do you feel? Should the owners be allowed to build the skyscraper? At least now you would have expressed your sentiment that yes, they should have been able to do that. Those of you who said no, okay, you would say no, it's got to stay just like this, because 2 million people go through and their whole general wealth, this was a case that was used, there's constitution stuff that talks about public health, safety, and welfare, and everybody knows public health, safety, this broadened the definition of welfare. For a person in New York to have the pleasure of going to work every day and enjoying this architectural ambiance and everything else, suddenly that became part of the general definition of general welfare, not like a fire escape or something else. Landmark case, 1978.
Was this privately owned?
Yes, it is. It's Penn Central's building. And that's why they said we should be able to build, we should be able to sell the air rights, the railroad. They should be able to have the air rights. And but the government, through the Historic Preservation Commission and others, said, no, you can't. Because speaking on behalf of all New Yorkers, we don't want you, one company, to be able to change the general ambience of this place. And the Supreme Court sided with the people of New York in stopping it. With no compensation. No compensation, so there's no eminent domain or anything like that involved. Yeah.
Do you know any cases of that similar thing happening with churches? Cities want to sell their air rights.
I don't know of any cases. You know, there might.
Fourth Presbyterian Church, Michigan Avenue, across from John Hancock, they tried to get air rights, and denied. The aldermen listened to all the homeowners in the high rises, and they spent $16 million in the church fighting it and lost.
I wish we had an hour to go. Number 12. Then what I'm going to ask you to do, I'm going to give you, quote, answers, and then I'm going to ask you to compare and see how consistent you were. Number 12, oceanfront. You know what coastal areas can be, particularly in the southeast coast. And South Carolina has some magnificent shoreline. Unfortunately, some of the shore is on sandbars, which are subject to considerable losses during major storms. So Mr. Lucas, he wanted to build there. To curb losses, though, the state proposed an ordinance which would prevent any additional conversion of unused land for residential purposes. Some owners, such as Mr. Lucas, said that such undeveloped land, they objected to that, claiming that would take away virtually all the value of their land. So should the state's proposal be approved? No more development on barrier islands in South Carolina. A yes vote will mean you're siding with the state, and a no vote means that you're siding with Mr. Lucas. Now, I'm going to have you total up your votes. And here, I'm not saying these are right or wrong, but I'm going to go down, I'm going to give you yes or no, and I want you then to total how many times you agree with what I'm reading. Okay, number one, N. Number two, Y. Number four, Y. Number 8, 9, 10, Y, 8, 9, 10, Y, 11, no, and 12, yes, or Y.
Yes.
Okay, so you have N, there are a total of 8 cases, I think, here, N, and Y for 1 and 2. Number 4 is a Y. And then on the back, Y, N, and Y. Now, how many of you had 8 answers that matched what I just read? One way or the other. Your answers were totally consistent. You either were in total agreement with those, or you were totally on the opposite side. All right? And so you had an 8. All right? How many of you had 7 of them that way? 2? And 6? And 5? And 4? Now, if you didn't have 8, either all in agreement with what I read, or 8, the opposite side, if you're anything in between, then in some measure people might say you're inconsistent. If you've had 8 exactly agreeing with I did, that meant in every case you were siding with the public good trumped the private rights. If you had answers different from what I read, that means in some cases you opted for the public good, but in some cases you felt the private property rights trumped the public good. Now, again, I wish we had a long time for this, but we only have 2 minutes, but I invite you to think or whatever. What do you think are the criteria by which, if you were on boards now, somehow this massive board making these decisions, what would be the criteria by which, in some case, you don't have to because you were 8, so you were consistent, but everybody else, what would be the criteria then that were in your mind as to why in some cases you voted yes for public good, but in other cases you voted for private rights? What were your mental criteria? That's why I never, even in class, we don't like to discuss each individual case much, but what is the criteria by which you maybe depart from what might appear to be consistent? Please.
Well, in number one, the private person's right to sell was in the interest of the public, so I think I'm being consistent. So
okay, that's a good point.
If you want a landfill, you're never going to make people across the road happy. It doesn't matter if they have vacant lots or anything.
Okay.
And so in order to have a landfill, you're going to have to make that tough choice.
Okay, so you were actually thinking of the larger public good, not about just these 8 homeowners across the street.
Well, and not on behalf of the private owner who wants to sell the land.
Yeah,
but that's functionally
right.
What the case was.
Okay, that's good.
I agree.
Yeah, the same. The
so there may be a larger public good than the immediate neighbors, and if we can generalize that, you're saying in some cases there's a larger public good, which sometimes forces you to go against the immediate. That's good. All right.
So could the same apply to number 8?
Could the same apply to number 8? Might be a tough sell. I'd like to hear your answer. The general public is running out of farmland a lot, and so the larger public good, more than Scott County, Iowa, or some other place, would be saying, the larger public good in that case would probably be saying, yeah, you better save every bit of farmland that you can. But I'd like to hear your answer.
I sympathize there also, because what role does the county have in providing food for the community or using that particular farmland for the public good?
To generate, if you're opposed to that, then you're saying because maybe by selling that to home developers, you improve the tax base?
Well, I'm just in favor, because this one is, of giving some autonomy to the farmer there.
Okay. But then we might say, well, how about, and that's a good, they're good points and they're brought up, how about giving that same autonomy to every one of the private owners? Why did that seem okay, but not some of the other private owners?
What is the cost put on the county or the entity by that, allowing this development to go on, and does that entity have a right to in governing itself, impose cost recovery?
Yeah, after it's flooded, huh?
And that, to generalize, that is an argument that can come up. You have, and in fact, there's something called the LaSalle guidelines, in which it's the obligation of a decision-making group to weigh the benefits. So rather than making things clear-cut, right or wrong, the LaSalle guidelines, 1957, say that it's the obligation of that to weigh the benefits of the requirement for the other in economic terms. And so that could be, in your mind, that's a criteria. A larger public good, economic consideration.
Well, I didn't vote according to this, but I can imagine that there's a way in which we look at some private property owners more sympathetically than others, and that would make us inconsistent at that time. For instance, you might think in our heads, these are farmers, you know, we keep living off the land, you know, a kind of perhaps that economic benefit for private sale of their land would be more acceptable to us than those rich people living on the beach that didn't want people walking in front of their houses.
One of the things we have to do, and if you're on a commission ever, is you have to divorce it from the people that are there. Because once the decision is made, it stands. We had a case in Lanka like that, a quadriplegic type person. Terrific person, wanted to be able to have an extension of the property into a residential neighborhood so that he could continue his garden saws and lawnmower business like that. Well, everybody, we ended up voting for that person, but we had to caution, Mr. Parr is his name, Mr. Parr, great citizen of Rock Island, great involved for 40 years, but he then, once he gets the zoning, he could sell it to tomorrow. And it could go to Mr. and Mrs. Jerk, who really are terrible owners of the property. So they tell us you have to just put blinders on. You can't make land use decisions in light of who happens to live there.
But they are made.
They are made. But pass this around. You had one, Peter. You were got money here, a comment from you. And if we need to, some of you are coming tomorrow. I don't mind taking a few minutes at the beginning of tomorrow's session. If some of you want to mull this over and see why you are consistent. But what were you going to apply?
Well, I just noticed for me, I have a bias in some of the water cases. And I think it particularly is stronger now than it would have been 10 years ago because of the vanishing nature of, you know, our clean water. And so, like in the lake case, I wasn't voting so much for or against the owners. Public property thing is I was trying to give the water a voice.
I agree.
Right. And so regardless of how it affected the owners, I really didn't care too much as long as the lake, which I think is like, I wouldn't say a person, but it certainly is part of God's creation and should have some rights. Mm-hmm. Although the law really hasn't traditionally looked at those things, you know, like a tree or a spotted owl or things like that. Normally don't have standing, you know, to bring cases, but that's somewhat changing.
But we have to stop, and I'm glad to end on that. And the reason this ends up being something why myself as a geographer or an environmental scholar and planner and so on this is that usually when you do get into situations of trying to prevent soil erosion, work for good watershed management, work for saving forests or for trees, in order to have the right policies, it is going to go across property lines. It's going to go across property lines, and so therefore you pass the ordinance because of strong environmental reasons. And I think everyone in the room ought to make sure that whatever you're passing, it indeed has a scientific base. And that's what happened in the Lucas case, by the way. The Supreme Court sided with Lucas, that's the South Carolina waterfront. But they sent it back, but the reason they sent it back is because South Carolina had not been precise in the law when it wrote it why they were telling landowners they couldn't be there. So if South Carolina would have been clear, and this is a sort of a warning to us environmental people, that if you're going to pass ordinance, you better put in the law itself very precise wording as to why we can't allow coastal development. Because of damages to the environment and damages to people, loss of life, etc. But that's why environmental people getting in, because as Peter said, you're concerned about what's going to happen to the lake. And that's the reason they want to keep it back, not because they wanted to step on those homeowners, but because they want to make sure those lakes are clean. But in order to make sure the lakes are clean, they had to tell 40 owners, you've got to build 75 feet back, and that triggers the storm. Oh, it's triggered. One last little quick start. That Lucas case that's there, so Lucas wins at the Supreme Court. So that means he can go back. Now he builds, so he has to get a permit from the state of South Carolina to build on the property. He gets a permit. The house is destroyed. He sues the state for allowing him to build in a dangerous property and wins.
And
wins.
Exactly.
I haven't seen, I've never seen that written up, but my friends at Duke University in their environmental management school, they say, trust me, that's what happened. Lucas won. So that's at that point you say, who knows what direction the law is going. Hey, thanks a lot.